This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to New Books and Film, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dan Moran. Alexander Greenhoff teaches in the program in writing and rhetoric at Stanford University and is also an admirer of the filmmaker Albert Brooks. The University Press of Mississippi has just released a collection titled Albert Brooks Interviews, edited by Alexander, and we are so glad to have him here today to talk about the book and the work of Albert Brooks as a whole. Welcome, Alexander.
Thank you very much for having me.
So let's start with that, with perhaps might be the hardest question of the whole interview. Why Albert Brooks?
Why Albert Brooks? Probably because I think he's really funny and his films make me laugh.
Well, that's true too, right? Now, Albert Brooks is kind of like a guy that like people may have heard of. Some people, when you point out, they say that they don't really know. They haven't seen Lost in America, but then you say you've seen Finding Nemo and they're like, oh yeah, Marlin. Like everyone knows him as Marlin. But I want to ask you to give me a reaction to what I found to be the truest line of the book. And this is from David Handelman's piece. He says this, and I'm going to quote him and then get your reaction. He says, Albert Brooks is like Elvis Costello or the Larry Sanders Show, where artist and audience see eye to eye, but the rest of the world seems to be off reading the Bridges of Madison County.
I think what's interesting about that quote from Handelman is that it's certainly reflective of when that article was written for yes. Premier Magazine in terms of those cultural references. But I think that the observation there about eye to eye is interesting because I think as well we could say it's ear to ear. So I think, you know, whether you've heard him on The Simpsons, whether you've seen him, you know, on television, it's eye to eye and ear to ear. And I think it's also that sense of one to one. So I don't know if Albert Brooks is necessarily an acquired taste. I think it's more sort of a case where it resonates with you or not. So I don't know if it's sort of so much that, you know, you would learn to appreciate the work. I think it kind of strikes you initially when you encounter it and it's like, this is funny or not.
That's I remember reading once that Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead once said that our band is like black licorice. Not everybody likes black licorice, but the people that do really like it.
Right. You really like it. Yeah, exactly.
So do you recall your first encounter with Albert Brooks and kind of what drew you to him and made you say this guy is something else?
Yeah, so I'm a younger Gen X person, and I think from the best of my memory that probably the first time I would have encountered Albert Brooks was him in Broadcast News. So I think I would have probably seen that movie as a teenager, and given that it's such an excellent performance, I think that's probably initially where I would have been like, oh, that's sort of, it was memorable, right? The character is memorable and the performance is really, you know, outstanding. And I think then later in my early 20s, I had read about Modern Romance and then watched it kind of cold with a friend, and we just were totally blown away. We were just kind of primed for it. So this probably, you know, when I was an undergraduate. Yeah.
Yeah, that's really funny because I had the similar experience of seeing broadcast news and saying that guy is really funny, and then I saw Lost in America, and I couldn't believe it. It's almost like you want to run around and say, why isn't everybody talking about this guy?
Yeah, he's amazing.
Yeah, he's amazing. He's amazing. So, there's 14 interviews in the book, and when you read them in a row, the cool thing about the book is it's almost like reading an Albert Brooks biography because some of the stories get repeated. He has to tell a lot of the stories at the same time. The book never feels repetitive, though. It's always fun to hear him tell the story again. So, how did you select these interviews? Because he's obviously done a lot more than 14.
Absolutely. So it was kind of a two-step process. Initially, when I wrote the proposal for the press, I had a planned list, a kind of, as a kind of draft almost of the interviews I wanted to include. And so then, as I was actively working on the book and doing further research, but then as well at the same time trying to clear the permissions, that's when the book actually took shape. And so that's the second part in terms of the two-part kind of part of, putting the interviews book together. I also found that in addition to wanting to have a good kind of span in terms of going from the early work or early interviews and then to recent interviews, I found that there were interviews I couldn't get the permission for, and that was a little frustrating. So there were a couple of interviews that coincided with the release of Mother, which came out in at the very end of 1996. And I unfortunately couldn't even contact the rights holders for that, for those interviews. So that was disappointing. But for the most part, I actually was able to get permission to reprint all the interviews that I wanted to include. I also found, and I'll share this with you, which just interested me, that interviews basically fell into three categories in terms of the rights. There were those interviews because they had been written by freelancers, journalists, and critics. And those typically were interviews where the rights holder, i.e., the journalist, basically gave me the interview gratis. Then there were the interviews, and a good example of this would be two interviews that appeared in Film Comment, where the rights holder was a non-profit. And that's where the fee that was requested was kind of nominal. And then there are a few interviews, but not many, where they're basically held by corporations or something along those lines, the profit seekers. And those were difficult to claim because the amount of money requested was really high. And so, because he is a kind of, I guess I call him a kind of a quasi-Hollywood person. I mean, I kind of write somewhere that he's both in and outside Hollywood, which I think there's some truth to that. Many interviews and profiles he did were for publications that were for a mass audience, and many of those are for profit, obviously. And so sometimes those were difficult to clear just because of the cost.
Yeah, people that assemble literature textbooks always talk about how the permissions fee is determined what the students are going to read.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's I want to cite that because I want to share that because that does shape this book. And I think it's actually fitting because there's a nice kind of parallel with Albert Brooks's own work, because I think as an artist, he's very cognizant of how, as a Hollywood, as I'm saying, kind of like quasi Hollywood person, his work itself reflects and is shaped by, the material conditions in which he's, living and working with him.
So let's talk more about his biography. And I learned so much about his life, as I said here. Take us through some of the major points, starting with his name.
Yeah, so he was born Albert Einstein. So he was born into a showbiz family, and his father, Harry Einstein, was a radio comedian. And he also appeared in films and television. And I think, at least as Albert Brooks kind of shares it, there's some sort of kind of maybe ambiguity of why Albert, but obviously there's the sense that it's a joke. But in any case, he grew up in Beverly Hills in the showbiz family, and later, as a teenager, was from all accounts just very, very funny. It's a funny family. So his brother, Bob Einstein, was known as Super Dave Osborne, who people might be familiar with from television in the 70s through to the 90s, really, as well as Funkhauser from Curb Your Enthusiasm. So it's a comedy family in that sense. And so he basically began his working life, Albert Brooks, as a I'll call him a comedian, but that kind of doesn't do necessarily justice to the kind of humor he was kind of exploring and using as a television performer. And so that's really kind of, you know, what he's known for at the beginning of his career. He's really a very young man. He appeared on variety shows and then later talk shows, recorded two comedy albums in the mid-70s, and then made six short films for Saturday Night Live for its very first season. And then really after that point, he's concentrated on making feature films, but he also acts. So mm-hmm. He has a long history as an actor in other people's films as well.
And of course, Lorne Michaels asked him to be the permanent host of Saturday Night Live when they first came up with the idea. And he said, no, I don't want to do that.
Yeah, exactly. He didn't want to commit himself to that. Yeah.
Your book also sent me back to listen to his Comedy Minus One album, which mm-hmm. you know, you can listen to on YouTube. And it's kind of funny that, like, it seems like if you like Albert Brooks, he's ill-suited to stand up, but you hear him doing it. And some of the interviews talk about how he got to a moment in Boston where he seemed to have this, like, Road to Damascus moment, right? Am I reading that right? Where he was kind of like, I can't do these two shows a night anymore.
Yeah, he talks about this in a recent documentary by his friend Rob Reiner,
right,
which is, I think, really insightful. And I think he got to the point where he just didn't want to do anymore. I think what's actually interesting about that to me is he actually only did live performance for about, from my understanding, about only 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So he actually began on television, which is very unusual. And then started doing stand-up. And half of that comedy album that you were listening to, that's from stuff that was done live. The other half of that album is stuff that he did in the studio.
Right. And he had that first film, which was so famous, which I urge everyone to look up on YouTube, which is Albert Brooks's School for Famous Comedians. Mm-hmm. can you talk about that movie? It's about that, this great 10-minute film.
Yeah, it's a great film. So that film itself is actually an adaptation. So he did a fake advertisement for Albert Brooks' Famous School for Comedians, and that appeared in Esquire magazine. And he then made a film based on that advertisement. And it's very clever, and it's very funny. And I think for people who are aficionados of American comedy of a certain era, really kind of, to me, 50s through to the point at which it was made, early 70s, it has a lot of in-jokes and references and performers that you would recognize. So it's fun for that reason, as does the Esquire piece. So it's a kind of meta-commentary on comedy itself, which is, you know, what he was also doing in his television bits, as what I was saying, like a kind of, like, again, I'm putting this in kind of quotations, but like a comedian. Because I think that's the other thing I think a lot about with that work that he did in that era, which is that certainly not strictly stand-up, that's for sure. And also just to call him a comedian is kind of limiting in terms of what he's actually doing on the variety shows as a performer. So I'd almost call him kind of like a comedic performer or something, which I know is a little, to me, it's a little different than a comedian.
Yeah, it's hard to talk about comedy, isn't it? It's hard to talk about what makes something funny.
Yeah, not only that, but I think just the kind of the borders between like what's stand-up and what's a skit and what's a joke, what's a bit, you know, all those things. And that's where I think he kind of lives and kind of performs in that era, and still really in a way, at those kind of blurry zones, if that makes sense.
Yeah, 100%. Because it's funny, you can't imagine him doing what, say, like Jim Gaffigan does.
No.
You know, or somebody like who's Jim Gaffigan, who's great at that, who walks out and talks about his kids and talks about his life and makes fun of himself. Like he seems like totally, totally ill-suited to that. And it's funny what you just said about comedic performer, because all those great bits on Carson, he would come out and do the, you know, you put different foods in your mouth and it makes you a different celebrity, or the speaker, like he came out, or with the ventriloquist. Mm-hmm. I mean, he would like he never came out and told jokes per se.
No, I think there's a quote somewhere, he's probably said this more than once, but I didn't tell jokes.
Right.
Yeah. I paraphrase him, but it's something like that.
Yeah. There's something about him where it's almost like the fun of watching Albert Brooks or you know, watching his movies. You get to like we kind of like to watch Albert Brooks walk around and be Albert Brooks, so to speak.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. I was actually rewatching Lost in America recently and has some wonderful tracking shots of him just walking. And yes, you're right. I mean, I think part of it is he himself is just funny. And weirdly, I've been thinking about this recently because I watched the finale of Curb Your Enthusiasm. And I was thinking like, yeah, Larry David is interesting to me because is he himself actually funny? Or is he an extraordinary writer? He's obviously a great performer, but do I find him himself funny in kind of the way that I find like Will Ferrell funny? I mean, I find Will Ferrell absolutely hilarious, just in the same way I find Albert Brooks hilarious. But I wonder if like, you know, this is where we can get into these sort of finer distinctions among comedians and comedic performers in terms of, you know, what actually produces the laughter.
Yeah, that's a great point because you just said, you mentioned in Lost in America, like when he's walking down the hallway to get what he thinks is going to be his promotion. Yeah. It was like, that's so funny when you watch it because we know it's coming, right? Everyone's good luck, good luck. But it's also, you just made me think that's kind of like in Curb when Larry's walking around his neighborhood in his blazer and his shirt. And you're kind of like giggling because you just know this isn't going to end well. Something bad's going to happen. So let's push this even further. You know, the success of Curb is that Larry David plays a guy called, air quotes, Larry David. And in so much of the Albert Brooks movies, like for example in Lost in America, I think his name is David Howard. Mm-hmm. But when we talk about that, you wouldn't say then when David Howard goes to get, you'd say no, and then when Albert Brooks, like you call him Albert Brooks. So you talk in the book, or the interviewers talk about this figure called the Albert Brooks character, right? So talk about the Albert Brooks character. Like, what is that?
I think there's actually in a way more than one Albert Brooks character. So there is the character he played using his own name really beginning in the early 1970s. So as an example, we have the famous school for comedians, and that's his school, i.e. Albert Brooks. And again, we have to put that name of that comedy character in quotation marks. And he also appears in many of the Saturday Night Live shorts. He also is the star of Real Life, which is Albert Brooks's first feature film, where he plays a it's actually just Albert Brooks making a documentary. And I say Albert Brooks, I mean the Albert Brooks character. There's also, though, after Real Life, so that's the first feature film, films such as Modern Romance and Lost in America and Defending Your Life and The Muse, where it is more maybe what you're referring to, where, say, he's playing David Howard in Lost in America, and that's the Albert Brooks character. So not a case where he's playing, a fictionalized version of himself as he did in the 70s, but instead it's a character where it's close enough, I think, to, and here I'm saying like the real Albert Brooks, so that for him, I think, as an artist, like a writer, director, performer, it can feel real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a strange thing that movies do to us, where we kind of think we know, we kind of know what actors are like, you know, and you hear people, when people meet somebody famous, you know, I met George Clooney. What was he like? Oh, he was so nice. He was such a nice guy. Like, we want to believe that. Right. But it's funny, like when you watch his movies, you know, I was just reminded of, he just did a recent episode of Conan O'Brien's podcast, mm-hmm. of him and Rob Reiner. And of course, like, he comes on the show and he sounds like Albert Brooks. Like, it seems like the distance between he and him and one of his characters isn't that far.
Yeah, certainly in terms of the Albert Brooks character in those feature films. So he obviously has, or maybe this isn't obvious necessarily, but he has a lot of range. So he can play non-Albert Brooks characters. Yeah. So probably the most notable example would be Drive, where he mm-hmm. plays a gangster. Mm-hmm. And that really, that character has nothing to do with the Albert Brooks character, nor the real Albert Brooks, obviously. So he has that that talent so that he can do that. Yeah, it doesn't happen that often, I think, in his work.
Do you think that knowledge of that Albert Brooks character influenced the folks at Pixar to pick him to do that voice for Marlin? Because it occurs to me now how much that is Albert Brooks as a clownfish, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. 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 Because that character, the Marlin character, reflects a lot of the, I guess I'll call it like Albert Brooks character that he developed in other movies. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Like his neuroses, he's always going, Nemo, Nemo, and like yelling. Like he yells a lot in his movies, right?
Yeah. So he's a warrior. The character of the warrior. And worries and anxieties are definitely a constant in all of Albert Brooks's movies.
Yeah.
That's the whole self-questioning and doubt. That's a major, those are major kind of features of all his films.
Yeah, certainly that first scene of Lost in America is him lying in bed worrying about he's not going to get the job and he can't buy the house. And then you just made me think of like Lost in, I mean, Defend Your Life. You have to sit there and look at all the dumb things you've done by using 3% of your brain and worry about that and how you're going to get through it. So that's a great point, is that, yeah, the worry is universal. It transcends genre and species.
Yep.
So we talked about the Albert Brooks character. We talked about Larry David. The third figure that the interviews bring in a lot is Woody Allen. A lot of, especially in his early, you know, when he broke on the scene, right? A lot of interviews compare him to Woody Allen. So talk about that. How that's a deserved or maybe an undeserved comparison.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Yeah, I actually write about this in the introduction to the book because a number of journalists referred to him as the West Coast Woody Allen. I'm not quite sure about the first time in print that occurred, but I think it's, you know, from the late 70s to the best of my knowledge. I think it makes a lot of sense in one sense that they're both comedians or comedic performers who then later wrote, directed, and starred in films. And I think additionally, they're both brainy and Jewish, and there's that kind of connection or parallel. I think one thing I'd stress in the introduction, which I think is worth remembering, is that Woody Allen and Albert Brooks are of different generations. So Albert Brooks, to me, is the kind of quintessential boomer artist, whereas Woody Allen is actually of a slightly older cohort, right? So I think that's a difference, which I think is important. Here's another way I should think about it when I think about it. You know, I can't imagine Albert Brooks making, you know, radio days in the sense that his childhood is a television childhood. So, you know, he grew up watching TV. I mean, he listened to a lot of radio too, and he loves radio. But I think, you know, his father was a radio performer, obviously. But I think for Albert Brooks, in terms of the mass media, not only is it cinema, but it's specifically television that he's sort of interrogating and kind of using as a kind of starting point artistically. Whereas to me, Woody Allen has these other reference points, not just radio, but then as well, literature, for instance, and philosophy. So that's another kind of important difference. And, you know, probably kind of most kind of obviously, and this is something I also point out in the introduction, Woody Allen obviously has this extremely, extraordinarily controversial, you know, personal life, whereas Albert Brooks doesn't.
Yeah, you just get the sense he's walking around being Albert Brooks.
Yeah, I think absolutely, yeah.
So I want to go back to something you said earlier and get I want to push a little harder on Brooks's niche or his fans. You said before that, like, you know, we like him because we kind of see eye to eye. Like, what is it about, you know, Albert Brooks, maybe in his vision of the world or of people that you think kind of like overlaps with our visions and kind of says, yeah, I like this guy, gets it?
That's a hard question to answer. So I can speak for myself initially, in that I think what I found refreshing about Albert Brooks, I was thinking about this with his movies just recently, that, you know, he is both the protagonist and bad guy in his movies.
That's
which
great.
I think is interesting. And I think that's kind of rare. I don't think there's many movies like that. And I think if you can appreciate, you know, why that's both entertaining and interesting, and, you know, can take you as a viewer somewhere funny, but also maybe prompts you to think introspectively about how you're both at the same time a protagonist and sort of a kind of, you know, maybe not so great. That's kind of, I think, maybe for people who are open to it, appealing about it. Yeah, his work.
That's great. Let's push this a little further with one of the movies. So you want to pick a movie like, say, Lost in America or Mother or The Muse, where and talk about that, how he is both protagonist and antagonist.
Yeah, so Lost in America is a good example. So that's a movie where at the beginning of the film, it's him with Julie Haggerty, who's his wife, in the movie. and they're yuppies. They're kind of quintessential 80s yuppies. And wealthy yuppies. I mean, they're very successful. And so he is about to, at the beginning of the movie, receive a promotion at work that he's sort of been anticipating and coveting for a very long time. And they're also about to move the houses. So they've actually kind of, you know, they've about to, you know, move to a bigger home. And so he goes into this, what he thinks is a meeting to hear about this great promotion. And this isn't so much of a spoiler, because this is the kind of the turning point of the first turning point of the film, but he learns, in fact, he's going to get a transfer. And it's one of the, you know, one of the great moments in an Albert Brooks movie, because he's so genuinely angry, and, you know, how he kind of explodes and the kind of the form it takes is very entertaining. But it's a good example where, you know, whether or not, you know, the viewer is necessarily like rooting for him at the beginning of the movie, I don't know. It's more that he kind of portrays or kind of presents the character kind of dispassionately in a way, which is, you know, I think reflected even in the visual style of the film. So the way you're kind of positioned as a viewer, that you're kind of encouraged to kind of see things through his perspective, but also just through the use of long takes and a kind of observational style, you're also kind of scrutinizing him at the same time. But the character himself is definitely a protagonist in the sense, like, yeah, you kind of want him to have this thing. You kind of know it's going to go bad because it's an Albert Brooks movie. But he's definitely as well, not only shitting himself in his own foot, right? In that moment with his boss, where he just loses it, and that kind of then is a catalyst for the rest of the movie. But additionally, you know, he can be both, and this is the most interesting thing about this movie. He can actually be very, not kind necessarily, but understanding and sort of, you know, forgiving to his wife, but also just absolutely awful, like awful, awful.
I lost the nest egg. I want you to repeat it. I lost the nest egg. Yeah. I lost the nest egg.
It's abusive, really. I mean, he's in a moment of like, and it's funny. I mean, that's the funny thing about this movie, which is that, you know, he can actually produce many things in one scene. And that not only is that scene where he's being fired an example of that, but certainly the moment where he confronts, his wife about the loss of the nest egg. Yeah. And that, you know, that is a scene that's like, both scary and funny at the same time, and that's pretty rare. Yeah,
that's great.
You can rewatch it and kind of see it both ways.
Because she's very likable. She's so likable.
Oh yeah, absolutely. She is a sympathetic character. Absolutely.
He's not that much. But you still like, you're still kind of on his side. It's kind of funny. Like, the biggest laugh for me the first time I saw it was when, you know, Julie Haggie loses all the money. She loses the nest egg, and they're at Boulder Dam, and she says, "Well, let's just split up the money. I'll take half, you take half. That's the fair thing." And he says, "The fair thing." And you're on his side, because you're like, no, that's not the fair thing at all.
Yeah.
So it's kind of funny how your sympathies go back and forth. And then, of course, when he's trying to get Gary Marshall to give the money back, and how pathetic he is, and you just know he's not getting that money back, but you can't help but like kind of laugh along with him.
Yeah, no, I love that scene with Gary Marshall. I can watch that anytime and laugh. It's so funny. Yeah,
it's great. So the last interview in the book is one that you conducted by telephone in 2018. And before we talk about that interview, I just have to ask you this. Were you nervous? Were you a little starstruck?
I was neither nervous nor starstruck. I was thinking kind of practically, in that I only had so much time to talk with him. And so I'd never spoke to him before on the phone. So, you know, the lines ring in, and then that's Albert Brooks on the phone, and the voice is immediately, you know, recognizable. And that was fun in that sense. But I think it was more a practical issue of, say, somewhat similar to probably, you know, your work recording the podcast, which is, you know, having things that I wanted to ask, and then figuring out what the flexibility was, knowing that this wasn't just going to go on as long as I wanted.
Right.
And that was, you know, that would kind of keep me on my toes as an interviewer. Because there were key things I wanted to ask. And then, you know, there were things where, you know, just depending on time, I might've asked a bit more, but then, you know, we only had so much time together.
I was glad in your interview that you talked so much about something that I don't think is totally apparent when you think about Albert Brooks, is his visual style.
Like, you know, we think about Stanley Kubrick or Hitchcock or something, right? Albert Brooks, you think of, oh, he makes these really funny movies. But like that he really does have a style. And you talk at one point, you say, I think he says that a movie, I like to have a movie is like people looking through a window. And I thought that was like really interesting. So can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think actually from my memory that he first uses that analogy with Gavin Smith in an interview from Film Comment, which is in the book and which is an excellent interview. So I highly recommend people check out that specific interview. It came out when The Muse was released or around that time. But no, when I say no, it's a New Zealandism of mine. I would say yes, he's definitely a stylish director if you are attentive. I think interestingly with him, you know, because half of it's so funny and you're laughing half the movie, you're not actually kind of looking at how carefully he's approaching the staging and the camera work. But probably Modern Romance is the one that's most clearly a case where he went in with a style in mind, which was, you know, a lot of long takes. So that film actually has some really notable long takes. Mm-hmm. But even in rewatching Lost in America, for example, recently, I was noting how, you know, still in that film, there's a lot of takes where it's just one take covering, you know, a lot of dialogue, for instance. But I think also in the Smith interview, Gavin Smith begins by pointing out there's a kind of classical approach. And I think that's probably true that, you know, if you think about someone like Howard Hawks, I don't know why I always think about Rio Bravo as an example, but, you know, if you even look at that beginning of the movie, which I've taught, you know, there's a kind of clarity and rigor to how it's, you know, staged and introducing characters. Albert Brooks is a little different in that I think of him as much as kind of an art filmmaker narratively than he is a classical director. But the visual style, I think, is an interesting, it's his. I mean, it's something he's developed over time. But I think it's him as a kind of amalgam of, you know, classical narration a la Hawks or someone like that. There are many directors we could mention. And then, you know, a kind of inflection from art filmmakers or art filmmakers who are working in an American context, like Kubrick is a good example, who I know it was an influence on Albert Brooks.
Yeah. And Kubrick, as I learned in an interview, he called Albert Brooks after he saw Modern Romance.
Uh-huh.
And told him how much. Can you imagine Albert Brooks? Like, can you imagine if we had a recording of that? Stanley Kubrick calling Albert Brooks to say how much he enjoyed Modern Romance.
That would be cool. Yeah, no, I would like to hear that for sure. Yeah, that would have been a surprise on the other end of the line for Albert.
Yeah, Brooks. Imagine being a fly on the wall.
Yeah, and he really holds Kubrick in esteem. That's very clear. Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. Do you think those long takes make, like, they also add to the humor of a lot of scenes? Like, I'm thinking of the Quaalude scene in Modern Romance, right? It's funnier because it the tension goes on for so long with just the word, tension is the wrong word, but holding that one take of him wandering around and making all these phone calls.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. You're given kind of space to absorb everything. You know, it's interesting too. I was thinking about Albert Brooks's early work on television in the early 70s. And those are, it's an odd thing to say, but those are long takes, right? So if you show up doing Danny and Dave, like he did, you know, he's making his own little movie with this, you know, dummy. It's the idea is it's the world's worst ventriloquist. And it's very funny. He did it a number of times on different shows, but different kind of variations on it. But point being that, you know, there being a kind of integrity or coherence in terms of, you know, just one thing occurring in one chunk of time and space. I think he took that to some extent into his approach to film directing.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So I want to ask you about something else in that interview. You talk in that interview with Albert Brooks about rewatching Broadcast News and how we seem to be kind of losing those kinds of films today. So do you think the industry, like as it now stands, like is making things harder for directors like Albert Brooks or like to find another Albert Brooks? Right? Because you say at one point, I think you say this introduction or at the end, you say that Albert Brooks makes movies about the stuff Hollywood usually hides. And so it seems like in our post, you know, Avengers era, I wonder if it's harder for people like Albert Brooks to come out with a 90-minute comedy for grownups.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think it's sort of both easier and harder. So because if you're a talented, energetic young person who's funny and you want to make your kind of work and share it, that's one thing, but then finding the audience, that's the challenge, right? So I was actually coincidentally reading a book review of a Biskin book, Pandora's Box, I believe is the title, about this, you know, well, it was about more than what is known as peak TV. But I think, you know, whether it's peak TV or kind of whatever the you know, the opposite of a peak would be. So with cinema, right? Because Hollywood used to make so many movies before, you know, in the golden era of cinema. Whereas, you know, now it's, you know, the amount of feature films that Hollywood produces. So I think that's a difficult question to answer, only because the whole kind of media landscape, whether it's, you know, cinema, cable television, streaming television, you know, I guess what I'd call, like, say, the moving images of the internet on YouTube and TikTok and Reels, is so different, in fact, from the era in which Albert Brooks was, you know, entering what was like the American media industry. It's kind of hard to say. So both harder and easier. But I certainly think that there's obviously a lot of amazingly talented young people who are making great work. Now, whether they can find an audience, I think that's the question. It's the same thing with musicians, right?
Yeah, yeah. That's funny what you said about audiences, because in that Conan O'Brien podcast episode where he interviews Albert Brooks and Rob Reiner, he makes the point that when Rob Reiner was on The Family, that, you know, every Sunday night, like, you know, a third of America was watching that show. And that today, if you can have a TV show that gets even a million people to watch it, that's a big, big hit. But there was a time when it was all the, and so when Albert Brooks himself said, you know, the first time he was on The Tonight Show, the next day you go to the dry cleaners, everybody watched Johnny Carson and everybody knew you. And that seems like that's kind of vanished. Right?
Oh yeah, it's wild. I mean, I remember reading somewhere that the MASH finale, so I think this is about 1983, I think it was seen by about a third of the country. Not talking about the percentage of television viewers at prime time, but actually, like, it was seen by, you know, nearly 100 million people. Yeah. I think and, you know, the best of my knowledge, you know, it's really, I mean, I don't know what the viewing numbers are, but it's like, you had the Super Bowl, right? And no longer the Oscars, obviously, because those ratings have been going down steadily over the years. But there's very little now that you could imagine that would command that kind of attention from viewers. Yeah.
Yeah. That's really interesting.
Yeah. Definitely atomized. Yeah.
Yeah. So we talked about, you know, the terrible comedian, and he also does a bit where he's the world's worst mime. Like, if people want to go back on YouTube and watch some of his early stuff, like, what would you recommend them to right now, if they're listening to this and they're in front of a computer, you want them to open up another tab on YouTube, what should they look for?
I definitely think he's really funny on Johnny Carson. So Tonight Show with Johnny Carson in the 70s. Those are all funny to me, if you like.
Yeah.
I mean, see, maybe you watch 5 minutes ago, this guy's irritating. I don't like it. But if you find that you're like, oh yeah, this is kind of funny, you'll enjoy all the Carson appearances. I also know that there's a kind of a super compilation of everything Albert Brooks ever did with David Letterman. Or on David Letterman, because David Letterman had more than one show, obviously, across the decades, but where he has something later than on Netflix. But in any case, him with Letterman is very funny. Him with Johnny Carson in a slightly earlier era, that's also great. And those are more sort of what I think of as talk show appearances. And then additionally, there are the variety show appearances, and that's where he's really doing more, you know, bits. Although he does bits on Carson too.
Yeah.
He does both with Carson.
And Carson.
I enjoy seeing him talk with Johnny Carson. That's fun.
I think those are the best ones. Like, and Johnny Carson loved him.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
I mean, Johnny Carson, you can watch those clips, and the first time you can watch Albert Brooks do his bit, but you just to watch Johnny Carson is hilarious as well, because Johnny Carson is laughing so hard at him.
Yeah, no, Johnny Carson's amazing. And, you know, it's actually just a reminder for me of all the stuff I haven't seen with Johnny Carson, because I grew up in New Zealand. Not only would we have not had Carson on television, either in the form of a rerun, I guess, if that's the right term, or repeat, but we didn't have late night talk shows in general. So a lot of that stuff is kind of a later in life discovery for me in terms of, like, you know, learning more about that American, the history of those American talk shows, and then being able to see some of them, you know, and a lot of it on YouTube, which obviously wasn't the case in an earlier era. That's right. One of the wonderful things about YouTube is that, you know, stuff that people would have kind of vaguely remembered Albert Brooks doing on television, they really wouldn't have been able to access until recently. So that's one of the wonderful things about, you know, streaming video today.
Yeah. And watching the Letterman appearances in preparation for doing this interview, it reminded me of how, you know, Letterman obviously loved having Albert Brooks on. He loved talking to him in a way that reminded me of how much he loved talking to Norm Macdonald.
It's funny you mentioned Norm Macdonald. I actually just watched him on the Seinfeld, you know, comedians getting coffee and cars. Yeah. So funny.
Yeah. So he's another person that's like funny. Yeah. Like, you get the sense just he would be funny at a diner. He would be just walking around.
Yeah.
That's so funny. And that Norm Macdonald also did stand up, but his stand up isn't necessarily any better when he would go on Conan or Letterman or something.
No. You know, actually, one other thing I was going to add about Albert Brooks, which I've also been thinking about in contrast to like a Norm Macdonald, is I noticed a pattern with, let's use as an example, the Johnny Carson appearances. Not all of them, but a lot of them. He also often worked with props. So he'll come in with a kind of routine that depends upon a prop. So that's why the Speak and Spell, if people look that up with Johnny Carson, that's early 80s, is very funny. But that, you know, and the hot potato bit that you already referred to. And so that's something that goes back to the beginning of his career, that, you know, he was always kind of thinking through comedically the possibility of sort of objects, which I think is also, you know, not how everyone approaches it. You know, so in Andy Kaufman, for instance, or Steve Martin, they were doing that slightly later. But I think, you know, in a way, there are people obviously before Albert Brooks who are using props, obviously, but I think he was especially creative in using them.
Yeah, that's so funny because when you think about Danny Dave, when he does the thing where he throws the dummy on the floor and smokes a cigarette, like, that strikes me, like, you can imagine Andy Kaufman thinking that was really funny.
Oh yeah, definitely. Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, oh, definitely. Yeah, it's also like what I was getting at earlier about, you know, you can't do that on radio. So that's also an interesting kind of thing that he's doing, which is very sophisticated. And you see this in all of his work, I think, which is there's a really rich and dense interplay of language and then what you see and sound, and he thinks in more than one dimension in terms of a comedy. It's not just sort of verbal jokes. He's not I love George Carlin, he's amazing, but he's not George Carlin. Different thing.
It's a different thing.
Yeah. You're not gonna have Albert Brooks and now going out on stage and just sort of ranting about things, right? Even though I actually really enjoy late George Carlin, or late Carlin, as it were, and the late George Carlin's late Carlin. that's just to say, you know, like any, you know, innovative comedian or comedic performer, artist, Albert Brooks, I think, is, you know, working sort of in more than one dimension with that kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And making it look easy.
Yeah, maybe. Why do you say that?
Because it seems like for the uninitiated, when you first start watching Albert Brooks, you kind of think, like, you know, he's playing himself. Oh, he's just walking around. But when you read the interviews, you see how much care he takes into his setups and to you know, the dramatic arc of things and doing these long takes and how much work goes into making it look effortless, you know?
Oh, right. Yeah. And a lot of work does go into it. Yeah.
So if you had to recommend, so someone's listening, someone says, you know, this guy, I've always heard about this guy, Albert Brooks. I want to see one of his movies. And of course you'd want to recommend them all, but if you had to give somebody a starter movie, what's your Albert Brooks 101 pick?
I would say Defending Your Life, which is his fourth feature film. And that came out in 1991 and he co-stars with Meryl Streep. And interestingly, I don't think it's necessarily even typical Albert Brooks. It has all the Albert Brooks themes and it has the Albert Brooks character, but it's very different from his earlier films such as Real Life or Modern Romance. But I would say the one to begin with, in fact, is Defending Your Life.
Yeah, it's a lot warmer than the other ones.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And the last question for you, what are some of your favorite performances by Albert Brooks in other people's movies, and what draws you to them?
definitely broadcast news. I think that's, as I was saying earlier in the podcast, it's an extraordinary performance, very human, a lot of depth to it. Touching, you know, but, you know, it's a complicated character and he's got more than kind of one thing going on, I think, you know, which is interesting. He's not a one note character, you know, unlike arguably the William Hurt character. I think that's part of the point of the characterization. So certainly broadcast news. I also like him, and this is, I don't think even necessarily a good movie, but he's in like 5 minutes of Private Benjamin. And that's, it's right. Just, if you like the kind of like abrasive, kind of obnoxious Albert Brooks, which I really appreciate, it's like prime Brooks. So I think that's the same year as Mon Romance. And he's just great. I mean, the whole thing is absurd. He's just very kind of funny. And if you find that kind of thing funny, he's like great in that performance. And hey, it's only 5 minutes.
Yeah. And then he's out. He's out of the world. And
he's
out of the movie.
Yeah, he's definitely out. Yeah.
He's out of the movie. I love, you know what performance of his I love? I just want to get a reaction to. I love his performance in Out of Sight.
Yes. Yeah.
That's the prisoner.
Yeah, he's great in that. Because from my memory, I was watching a bit of that on YouTube recently where George Clooney kind of shows up in his office to confront him.
Yeah.
And no, he's very good. I actually haven't seen that film in a while. So it's been a while. But great movie. And so did it's obviously very talented director. Yeah.
Yeah. He's in jail and Don Cheadle's giving him a hard time and they kill his goldfish.
Right.
Yeah. So it's great. So Albert Brooks interviews are available everywhere. This book is highly recommended. Alexander Greenhoff, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us about Albert Brooks.
Thank you very much for having me.